What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It has been 820 days since October 7th, 2023. According to Al Jazeera, Israeli attacks have murdered at least 414 Palestinians and injured 1,145 in a daily so-called ceasefire violation since October 10th. The Israeli military has spent the past 24 hours expanding the so-called ever-moving, invisible to everybody except for Israel yellow line in eastern Gaza, particularly in eastern Gaza cities Tafah, Shujaya, and Zaytun. According to Al Jazeera, teams on the ground squeezing Palestinians into ever smaller clusters of the enclave. The Israeli army's actions on Monday are also pushing it closer to the key artery of Salah al-Din Street, forcing displaced families sheltering near the area to flee as more of them come under intensive threat, as Israel's genocidal war on Gaza shows no signs, zero, zip, zilch signs of abating. In terms of a total death count, those numbers were hard to find this morning, but we know that we are talking around 72,000 people officially recorded, with estimates by experts closer to 200,000. Our guest today is Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire borders and migration. And before my listeners go, well, what about? We will be, as I'm sure you can imagine, Curry, touching on Venezuela, which actually also impacts the Middle East region. Who'd have thunk? Welcome, yes, Curry. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Kat. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you, good too. Talking. This is where we find ourselves. Well on way to year three of a genocide, two failed ceasefires, a U.S. president who's kidnapped another world leader, and a prime minister who's using what just happened in Venezuela as an opportunity to escalate threats against Iran. As per usual, when we start our conversations, I'm just going to give you a minute to broadly respond to all of that.
Well, first things first, I hope that folks listening got a little rest over the holidays, because this is going to be evidently a busy year. For those of us who care about social justice and who know that social justice has no borders, get ready, because everything that we are working against, everything we are working for, it's only escalating and expanding. So, and we see that obviously with Venezuela, but we see that in Gaza as well. And I really appreciate you maintaining this space, Kat. You know, as Gaza kind of slips from the headlines of mainstream media, the fact that we have this and continue to talk about what's happening in Palestine is extremely important.
Two things to that. Yeah, I told Tandi Chimarengo, who has both substituted as a host here, substituted to David D, as a host on KPFK, longtime journalist, revolutionary activist, comrade. We were texting. They texted me, I think, at like almost midnight on over the weekend, right, as we were getting the news reports that Trump had invaded Venezuela and kidnapped Maduro. And all I could write back was 2026 going to be a mother bleep. But I also said, and we're not ready. We're just not. I mean, I just think that, I mean, I think some of us are. I think some of us been ready, right? I think some of us have been training for this for a long time. I think there's still a really large, large segment of the population that is still playing catch up to like, yo, is this really happening? Mm-hmm. I see world peace leaders still praying for the saving of the United mm-hmm. States democracy, right? Which makes me want to throw my computer across the room. Mm-hmm. And then I think, you know, the war tactic, literally it's a war tactic of shock and awe, mm-hmm. right? That we have just been so, right, it's one thing after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other, has a lot of people really shell-shocked. Yes. In terms of the it is all interconnected, right? Like when you sit and you actually read the headlines, and if you're, or you go past the headlines, and you're getting your news from sources that are not CNN and MSNBC, yep, I said it out loud, then you start to be able to put the pieces together. And so we will, right? We're going to talk about Iran. We're going to talk about Lebanon. We're going to talk about, right, in the ways all of this stuff interconnects. But yeah, it's we are off to 2026 with a literal bang. I do, however, to your point, because somebody else also texted me, they were like, what are we going to do about Venezuela? And I said, and this may be unpopular, I said, I will go to protest about the invasion of Venezuela. I will speak at said actions if people ask me to. I will talk about Venezuela on my radio show. All of this other stuff is still happening. Palestine is still happening. Sudan is still happening. Black people are still being murdered by United States police. Black folks are still sort of at the apex of the folks that are suffering most due to Trump's conditions in this country. And that's my work. And I say that to say there is interconnectedness, but the interconnectedness of the oppression has to be reflected in interconnectedness of struggle, meaning that all of us need to continue doing the work that we are doing while having the conversation about how that work ties together, as opposed to issue hopping in reactionary manners. So there are organizations that do international work. There are organizations that have long been fighting actually to try to protect the socialist movement in Venezuela. What do they say we need to do? Because they're actually the experts, and those are the leaders. Venezuelans are the expert. Those are the leaders that follow them, right? Palestinians are the experts. They're the leaders that follow them. Black folks, we're the experts on what's happening here. So I just say that to say, like, y'all, we got to stay aware of it all. But we got to stop dropping all of the other balls to just be focused in one place, because that's actually an unintentional, well, I think an intentional
Yes.
impact of the shock and awe strategy.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. I mean, if I could just say a word about that. I know we're gonna zoom in on Palestine and the Middle East, but I mean, yeah, everything comes into context, right? And what the US is doing in Venezuela right now is coming into context. There's obviously a very deep and long context of what the US has done. I mean, there's a deep, long context of colonialism, of 500 years of colonialism. We can talk about the past, since the 19th century of the U.S. in Latin America. All that is context, right? But just to zoom in closer to where we're at right now, one of the things that is very frustrating, and I am working to be patient with, and I encourage others to be patient with as well, but I will admit that it's difficult to hear in mainstream media is this kind of surprise of like, we thought that Trump was an anti-war candidate. What he says that he's an isolationist. Why is he carrying out these military actions? And I really, really hope that we can dispense with the notion that Trump came to do anything other than exercise military force, to achieve what he wants. And I do think that Trump has had a project of really reestablishing a very aggressive US militarism domestically and around the world. Domestically, I think it's painfully obvious, that is painfully clear. And one thing that has to be said is they are working to blur and destroy any lines between police and military, domestic and foreign. And again, I think that a lot of people have been rudely awakened of that over the past year, but certainly what happened in Venezuela, where they're saying this is an FBI DEA action couched in, a military operation. They're destroying those lines between police and militarism. Again, you know this very well in your work. On what we see in Black communities here, there's a version of that, right? But the other thing is, let's just talk about the past year. I mean, should we be surprised that Trump is escalating militarily? He began last year with bombing Somalia, that continued into a bombing campaign in Yemen. They bombed Iran. They fully embraced Israel's genocide in Gaza. Trump appointed himself the chair of the committee that he created that is supposed to be in charge of Gaza, and they ended the year by bombing Nigeria. So this is about establishing the notion that the US has the right to do anything militarily, and that there should be no accountability, certainly to international law, but really no accountability whatsoever. And so actually what we're seeing in Venezuela part of that story, we have to talk about what all they've done in Gaza, because that has been the key place where they have piloted the notion that the U.S. and its allies can operate with absolute impunity.
I mean, we're here, so we'll stay here just for a second. We will get to Palestine, I promise. If you go back and you look at the 2025 national security strategy, they actually laid out what their approach to Latin America was going to be.
Yep.
Which they are affectionately calling, wait for it, my peoples, the Donroe Doctrine, which is the... Y'all can see McCurry shaking their head.
Yeah, y'all can't see me and Kat cringing right now on video, but trust that it's happening.
The Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine was basically said, right? The United States would go out and do whatever the heck it wanted to in the name of whatever it decided, and was about the expansion of United States imperialism. And this is what they are unapologetically, blatantly, and boldly saying, yep, we're about to do this again, the 21st century remix.
Yeah, that's right. And so, again, the context for what the U.S. is doing, for what the Israeli state does, is a kind of colonialism. And on one hand, it has very deep roots that go back centuries. And yet, when something's set in motion 500 years ago, it doesn't just stay in motion. It has to be reiterated every day. It has to be reinvented in the 21st century. And Israel has piloted that. I mean, you know, to talk about settlers and settlements, to use openly kind of religious justification to steal other people's land and to work to annihilate those people, you know, that those kinds of projects were very much at home in the West, and what the West did in the Americas and elsewhere around the world in the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. But to pull it off in the 21st century, they need to kind of reinvent it and recast it. And that is Israel's specialty, to legitimize in the 21st century, oh yeah, this is just anti-terrorism now. You know, we're going to call it that. Yeah. And what is the U.S. saying in Venezuela? Oh, this is narco-terrorism, right? So they are trying to, this is really, we have to understand this as, on one hand, doing some things that are very familiar. And on the other hand, there's a lot of experimentation, actually, that Washington and that Israel are doing right now to figure out, what does this look like? How do we continue the same project in the 21st century? What does that look like? And that's why I think we have to be really careful, actually, that we don't just look back at what the U.S. did in Latin America in the 20th century, or even, frankly, what Israel has done for many decades, and say, oh, this is just a repeat of that. Because there are these familiar elements, but I think that we're also in a new era, and we have to understand it. And I think that what you are saying about an analysis that integrates these things and sees their interconnection, sees their particularities as well, right? Yeah. But also sees where they're connected is extremely important as we understand and resist this new reality that they are trying to impose in Palestine, you know, in Latin America, and on all of us.
And I'm so desperate looking for analysis and not just reaction, right? Because
yes.
It's so critical to inform our strategy. And I think just organizing, I'm looking, Makani Tembo, an amazing organizer, activist, reposted something from Serantos Fotopoulos. And I will link to it in archive. That is a pretty solid analysis, but and we have to be rooted in analysis and not reaction. And we're just so overcome by emotion. And people sometimes are like, Kat, you're so cold. It's like, I'm not cold, I'm calculated, because I want to win. We can cry later. We got work to do. All right, we start with the macro, and I'm probably going to come back if we have time to talk about Venezuela, but we started with that. I want to backstep macro going into micro, but I want to start with why the invasion of Venezuela, the bombing of Venezuela, and the kidnapping of Maduro and his wife would prompt Iran to be nervous and Netanyahu to say to Iran, basically, you're next. In what ways have Iran and Venezuela been longtime allies? And why would this brazen move by the United States fuel Netanyahu feeling like, oh, well now, right, we can do what we say we've been going to do? Because we're going to say they ain't acting right. That's what we're going to say, no matter. I mean, right. Iran could step, you know, stand down, hands up, tail between legs right now. That's not going to happen, but they could. Netanyahu's still been pushing for invasion. Connect these dots for us, please, Curry.
Yeah, first, just a word about where Iran, the Iranian government and the Venezuelan government have sort of converged, because there's a U.S. discussion about this that is deeply problematic, that says, well, here you have two dictatorial regimes that both have these sort of ideologies of terror and violence, and you know that their collaboration is ideological, right? And there is again this kind of U.S. invention of so-called narco terrorism that is such a that you know I won't elaborate, but suffice it to say, you know, the U.S. has crafted over many years a war on drugs. They have crafted over many years a war on terror. Both of these have been contexts that have been used to dehumanize people and to impose the will of the U.S. government through violence. And it's very convenient that they can present a villain that is somehow the convergence of that lies at the intersection of these two wars. That's their sort of narrative. What I would say is that these are two countries that, along with others, have been isolated by the U.S. economically, have through U.S. sanctions, they have made consequences for other countries doing business with Iran and Venezuela. And in that isolation, that breeds a kind of convergence. I mean, Iran and Venezuela say, okay, y'all are facing economic challenges. We are too. Maybe we can kind of get together here, right? That's true not only with Iran, but with any number of countries, actually. And frankly, Maduro's government has not been very selective, let's say, when it comes to who they're down to do business with whoever wants to do business with them, right? So that's just, I want to put that out there. Why would Iran be worried, or more to the point, why should all of us be worried about what happens in Iran, which is what I would argue, is I think it's pretty straightforward. If the U.S. can decide unilaterally that any foreign head of state has violated U.S. law, and that therefore the U.S. can unilaterally use its military to go ahead and invade that country's territory, kidnap its head of state, and then try them, in Pam Bondi's words, on American soil and American courts with American justice, that is an extremely dangerous precedent. Of course, truthfully, every place in the world should be afraid, but obviously Iran, because the U.S. has threatened and Israel have threatened our so-called regime change in that country for so long. And so to be clear, they are threatening Cuba, which of course has been on the list of countries that the U.S. has wanted to overthrow their government for many decades. They are threatening Colombia. I'm not going to repeat what the president says, because incredibly, it's illegal for us, according to FCC regulations, to use his words.
Really?
He just used in a press conference, but he said that Gustavo Petro of Colombia should watch himself. That's my euphemism for what he actually said. Okay. And they also threatened Mexico. So that's the U.S., you know, Trump feels like they're on a roll. And of course, the question of what happens in Iran, and can the U.S. or Israel take this as license to say we want to attack Iran in the name of regime change? Of course, that is a legitimate concern. This comes, by the way, as there has been growing unrest among Iranian folks, because of the disastrous economic situation that exists in Iran, which it must be said has a lot to do with the decades-long U.S. sanctions regime in that country. But there's also unrest directed at the Iranian government, you know, by Iranian folks. And the U.S. and Israel have a long history of manipulating whatever grievances people are raising in Iran and in other countries around the world and saying, oh, yeah, and therefore you're actually aligned with what we want to do in regime change. And we should not get confused about that. Right. We should not mistake unrest in Iran as purely the machination of, you know, U.S. imperialism, though U.S. imperialism, of course, is always present, you know. So yes, it's very scary at the moment. That there's a kind of momentum that I think the U.S. has after doing what it's done in Venezuela, or what it's doing in Venezuela, and using that to potentially threaten other countries elsewhere.
Well, just one more thing to note, because it's so audacious in terms of the United States. Part of what they've said in terms of whether or not they would invade Iran is if Iran attacks protesters, then that would be the that would be the U.S. justification to go in and protect those protesters, because, you know, that's what this administration does. It protects protesters. The other thing to bring to light is the other thing to I just lost my entire and total train of thought, Curry Peterson Smith.
I understand, but yeah. Suffice it to say that this is a. There's, I mean, I too am at a loss for words if we're talking about the U.S. and the Prime Minister of Israel claiming to be speaking in the name of democracy in Iran, when Israel is carrying out a genocide in Gaza, has invaded and attacked many countries, and the U.S. has just unilaterally decided not only to arrest a head of state of a foreign country, but to then say that the U.S. secretaries of war and state will now be in charge. Nobody can take seriously the notion that the U.S. wants democracy in Iran or anywhere else, including the United States, by the way, if we're talking about repression of protesters, which we, many listeners will know a thing or two about personally from what we are facing here.
It came back to me. Iran's response, right, was that should Israel and the United States make a move on Iran, that Iran's response would be greater than anything the enemy, meaning Israel and the United States, could imagine. And I'm putting that in the context of what you just pointed out for listeners, right, Curry, which is that they have threatened Mexico, they have threatened Colombia, they have, right, there's this rolling list, they're bombing Yemen, they're bombing Nigeria, they're bombing Somalia, what I don't believe, like, so where I see silver lining, if I may, and it's a distorted silver lining because I've got a interesting view of how we're going to get free, FCC probably don't want me to talk about that either, but... What I feel pretty assured of is that third world folks, developing country folks, are not just going to lay down, right? It's not just going to be you're not just going to roll into Cuba,
right,
and overthrow the Cuban government. Like, that's just sort of not going to happen. And so whether or not it's a united global response that the U.S. is fostering through global oppression in all these places, or if it's just that the forces of the enemies become so spread thin because they're battling people's resistance movements in all of these countries, it's not going to be a smooth sail, right, for the United States to make these moves. I don't doubt that Trump will do it. I now believe that. I believe the things he says. I believe that they're either emotional now or they're going to come late. I believe him.
Yes.
And I believe that white people are so arrogant, white supremacy is so arrogant, that they believe they're just going to roll over these brown and black people. Howsomever, I do not think that is true. And I think that actually, and we've talked about this before, that the resistance in Gaza has been fuel for so many of us around the globe.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that you're right. And, you know, of course, what comes to mind is in the 20th century, at the height of movements, you know, around the world against colonialism, at the height of movements in this country for Black power, for brown power, you know, there was a sense, an internationalist sense, that struggles are connected across borders, that we have common enemies, and so on. You know, that was a view held by millions of people around the world in the 20th century. And on one hand, I think that a certain set of chapters of resistance, you know, in that era have closed, right? We're in a new era. And so the challenge is for all of us, I mean, for you know, our relatives around the world, our relatives in Iran and throughout Latin America, in Palestine, but for all of us, actually, is what are the politics and what do the movements look like of a kind of collective, transnational set of freedom struggles in the 21st century? You know, it won't just be a repeat. It's going to be something new, just like what the U.S. state is doing. They are drawing on some histories, but they're experimenting with some new things.
Yeah.
And we've also got to experiment with some new things. So that's this time we're in, you know, and I appreciate your framing of this as a bit of a silver lining. If we are in a moment of transition where they are experimenting with all kinds of ways, if they're saying, look, we're not going to, we don't know about NATO anymore. We might want to do some different things. Well, if they want to do some different things, then we need to do some different things too. You know what I mean? Like, I think that there's an openness that they are using to carry out unreal violence, but we need to go into very critically and thoughtfully, taking what we've learned from the last century and the beginning of this one, but also thinking about what does it look like now?
Yeah, agreed. And just to go full circle back to, that's why the analysis is so important, right?
That's right. It can't just be hot takes.
I said, Nazim, we cannot organize in the present without understanding our past. And so, yeah, no, it's not a repeat of what the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army and the Brown Berets and it's not a repeat of that. It is an evolution of a strategy that threatened the white supremacist global power to the point that it went on an all-out mission to annihilate any and all resistance by people of color.
Yeah.
So, do your reading. Not you, Curry, the listeners.
Me too.
You are well read. All right, we've got about 13 minutes left, and I got to go to Palestine. So I'm looking at where I want to start, and I think I'll just start in environmental context, right? We're in winter here in America. You're in that really, really cold place. And I mean that literally and figuratively.
In every way. Boston, Massachusetts.
That's probably some Bostonians that listen like, all right, Kat, you got one more to talk about our place, but like for real. It's been like biting cold here.
Yes.
Right. Global warming also means colder winters.
That's right.
But I'm inside, right? I get to make a decision to go inside when I get too cold. I want to talk about, as we here in America have celebrated various versions of the holidays, what storms, continuing onset of winter has meant for Palestinians that do not have any shelter, that are sheltering in buildings which infrastructure is dangerous, which is further impacted by storms. We know buildings are falling on people. Talk about what the last, I haven't been on the air since the middle of December. Talk about the last few weeks for folks in Gaza.
I'm so glad that you're starting here, Kat. And I think about it exactly the way you do. It's been a cold winter here. It's a very cold winter in Palestine. That is in terms of the temperature, that it's also in terms of the storms, like you're talking about. There have been some disastrous winter storms, and you have virtually an entire population that is unhoused. I mean, the vast majority of structures in Gaza have been destroyed. Whole cities have been razed. And so you have literally, nearly 2 million people living in either compromised structures or tents, hundreds of thousands of people living in tents. And now that is disastrous in and of itself. But very recent news out of Palestine is that the Israeli government has denied, it has suspended the permission of 37 international aid organizations to operate in Gaza.
What the
You
heck?
know, this is part of a long-standing literal war on UNRWA in particular. UNRWA is the UN agency that is charged with attending to the needs, the humanitarian needs of Palestinians, Palestinian refugees in particular. And they do that in the West Bank. They do that in the refugee camps in Lebanon and elsewhere outside of Palestine, as well as in East Jerusalem and in Gaza. And they have killed members of UNRWA. They have called UNRWA illegitimate. And they have done everything they can to prevent UNRWA from operating in Gaza. Now they are doing that with other aid organizations, including Oxfam, including Doctors Without Borders, including the Norwegian Refugee Council. So these are organizations that have been sustaining life, for Palestinians in Gaza. These are organizations that employ Palestinians in Gaza, by the way. So it's not only just literally the means of survival in terms of tents and whatnot. It is also a question of income. All of that is being denied to folks, and they are exacerbating a humanitarian disaster in the winter. It's devastating.
Thank you, Kerry. Yeah, I was going to get to the organizations. I had for the first time the Norwegian Refugee Council on the show, just like I think the week that I was leaving or the week before that, and they were sort of bracing for no longer being able to provide aid. And because there's the permit, I think that's the right word, the permit you have to apply for to be able to operate in Israel is the one that approves the permit, and they can decide for any reason that the wind blows, right, that they're not going to do that. Materially, then, if you've got A blocked off and you've got existing, or I mean, Doctors Without Borders were some of the few remaining doctors that were operating inside of the shell of structures of what's left of hospitals that were repeatedly bombed by Israel, where the people that are still being bombed by Israel could go, not to mention the folks that are just starving to death that line the hallways, and hallways is in air quotes. So we're just talking about an exacerbation, a dramatic exacerbation of existing conditions, huh?
That's right. And not to, well, to state the obvious, but it needs to be stated and restated and restated. The goal since before 1948, when the establishment of the State of Israel, the goal has been to forcibly remove as many Palestinians from this land as possible. Do that through killing them, do that through terrorizing them so that they flee their land and so on. And throughout this 2-year genocide, Israel and the U.S. have been very actively talking to other, been talking to Sudan, been talking to Somaliland, been talking to Malaysia about, been talking to, been forcing upon South Africa, Palestinians who they are working to force out of Gaza. So they're trying to remove people. And the goal has been, the strategy has been to make Gaza unlivable. That has been the strategy for a very long time. This is the latest step. And so you have people surviving on the meagerness that is tents and food supplied by these organizations, these humanitarian organizations for refugees, and now that is being made illegal. And by the way, the pretext that Israel used they demanded that these organizations give them a list of all of their Palestinian employees, who, by the way, according to the UN, 500 aid workers have been killed in Gaza. So to hand over a list of your employees is obviously a death sentence, and these organizations, to their great credit, refuse. And on that basis, exactly what you said, Israel has denied their permits to operate.
So do they just keep moving? Like, I mean, I had Shayna Lowe on the show, and props to her. I don't see, or maybe I'm wrong. Like, do they just pack up and leave, or do they just put their bodies on the line and continue to do what it is that they need to do? And how does Israel then enforce, yo, we said you couldn't be here anymore?
So it remains to be seen what exactly they will do. I have to give credit to, you know, these organizations and their employees who have been quite defiant. And there's other organizations that are much smaller. You know, they just don't have the kind of scale that something like Oxfam or the Norwegian Refugee Council has, but there are other organizations that exist too. But yeah, aid workers are being incredibly defiant. World Central Kitchen, I mean, all these organizations who have seen their employees killed over these 2 years continue to operate. And of course, Palestinians continue to be resilient in the face of all this. And so, again, look, I mean, you and I have talked about this many times. The idea that you can just get rid of Palestinians is a Zionist settler fantasy.
Yeah.
All right. Palestinians are not, not a group of people that's just going to collectively commit suicide. All right. They're here to stay. And so what this means is a new chapter of hellish conditions in which they are surviving with their allies in the aid community.
I want to talk about the Palestinian Authority for a second. The Vice President Hussein al-Sheikh held discussions in Cairo on Sunday with senior Egyptian officials talking about the second phase of the ceasefire agreement, which made my head explode a little bit because I was like, first of all, the first phase meant that Israel was supposed to stop bombing people. I mean, not for nothing, right? Like, this big thing that didn't happen.
Right.
El-Sheikh, said that the talks address ways to consolidate stability across all Palestinian territories and move towards the second phase of President Trump's plan, as well as relevant UN Security Council resolutions. I didn't realize the UN had relevant Security Council resolutions, but, you know, what do I know? I'm just a radio host. How did the Palestinian people react to the PA's continuous selling of them out? I know that there's them brazen words. I've tap danced around it, but I don't know what else to call it at this point.
Right. I mean, I think the short of it is, I think that is, Palestinians, and in this sense, they're not alone, actually, are there's a real crisis of Palestinian political leadership, you know, and there is a question of, I mean, I was just talking about what do the politics of freedom look like, you know, for, I mean, our kind of freedom, you know, of liberation, what do they look like in the 21st century? We've all got to figure that out. And in Palestine, certainly, you know, folks have to figure that out. The Palestinian Authority was crafted to be a partner of the Israeli state. It receives its funding via the Israeli state. Israel collects its tax revenue for reasons that I don't fully understand. Israel supplies its weapons, Palestinian Authority, security forces, so-called trained with Israeli forces, and so on. So I don't want to, and there's more to it than that. The PA employs many people, you know, a lot of the Palestinian economy is based on the PA. So I don't want to be one-sided in my portrayal of it, but yes, there have been in recent years, all kinds of challenges by Palestinian folks to the PA's, rule. And it is trying to find a niche for itself within this so-called new Gaza that Trump is supposedly pursuing. And the PA is kind of bending over backwards to try to fit itself in. And to everything they offer, Israel won't take yes for an answer. You know, Israel, it seems like there's, even despite the extent to which the PA has kind of allowed or worked with or in coordination with Israel. Despite all that, Israel seems not interested actually in having the PA really act as a partner or having any real role in Gaza in this new kind of iteration of what Trump's trying to do in Gaza.
Well, they're Palestinian, for God's sake, so they can't actually be involved in rule of Palestinians in Israel's Gaza. Read the.
And if I could just say briefly on that, there is a military base in, you know, what is called southern Israel, on Israeli territory, on the other side of the line from Gaza, that is run by the United States. This is the base of operations that is supposedly coordinating everything that's happening in Gaza. It is a U.S. operation done in close collaboration with the Israelis, and there are zero Palestinians present. There are officials from other countries that are allowed in. Palestinians are not among them. So there, again, we began this conversation, and I will reiterate it again. This is about a kind of, what does colonialism look like in the 21st century?
And we will continue that conversation the next time we have you on, Curry Peterson-Smith. You make Mondays better. So thank you for coming on. So
always grateful to be here, Kat. Thank you.
Take care, Maji. Be safe.
Peace. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.